following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
He's an American icon who fought in World War II, gave you Martin Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704, Hauser, Channel 11 and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. No matter who you are, no matter what you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
So, this is All of the Above with Norman Lear. I have my identification papers. I've read them. I am Norman Lear. It's also, I have a belt that has, it's hanging, you know. Why am I being looked at this way?
Because I'm waiting to see if it has.
Because I want to talk about my belt.
Well, I want to know if it has like an NL or if it has the full name.
No, it's just a belt. On the inside, it has my full name.
Oh, that's very
good. Etched into it?
You're not here yet.
You're not here yet.
You're on your way. Because we're going to build it up. We got to build it up.
Michael Angelakis is our guest tonight.
He's not here yet.
I said it correctly, you out there. Michael Angelakis.
Yeah.
Is that not right?
If Michael's listening on his way here, he's going to hear that you have said his name correctly.
I have said his name correctly. He's our guest tonight. We're excited about it. He has a band. I think he's the center of this band, Passion Pit.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he knows it, but I went to Emerson College where he went to Emerson.
Oh.
Yeah. So we'll see if he knows that, which is a lot of shit because I've already talked to him actually sitting across the table.
And but you'll recreate that.
Yeah, so we've been through on that. Here he comes. He's entering now. It is Michael.
I can't believe
Angelakis.
He's here.
Angelakis.
I'm so sorry I'm late.
Well,
but it's characteristic.
You're very welcome. Late or early, it doesn't really matter.
That's a welcome I don't usually get.
So I understand that we have Emerson College in common.
We do. Yeah. I think I was there for about a little over 2 years, maybe.
Uh-huh. Studying?
Media criticism and theory. Yeah. So I studied, I studied your show. I studied many of your shows, and I studied a lot of I guess at a certain point it got to the existentialist sort of thing where I ended up leaving school. I did study. I actually even wrote two papers about your work.
Really?
Yes.
And they were entitled "What a Lot of Shit."
It was an extremely interesting time. I loved my time at Emerson, actually.
I did too. Adored my time at Emerson.
I missed Boston especially too when I left. I mean, you know, I was living in Cambridge and taking the train over, but I also lived at 100 Beacon, the original campus, which you know.
And I lived at 270 Clarendon.
There you go.
Clarendon, it came back.
Do you know where that is?
Mm-hmm. It's on the same side, yeah.
There were about six guys who lived with in that, it wasn't a dorm, it was a, belonged to the Lawlesses. The Lawlesses, I see their faces now. And we were there, it had been a girls' school up to then.
That's right.
The Emerson College of Oratory, it had been called.
That's right.
Now, speaking of that,
my great grandmother, she studied with a professor there, and she was, this is like, I mean, early, it must be the 20s or the 30s, right? When was that school founded? It was founded pretty early on.
No, it was in 1904 or something.
Yeah, like that. She won declamatory contests. I mean, she was an incredible orator, and it was like, and actually, she's who I named, my great grandmother is who I named all my companies after, Wishart.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What year might she have been there?
She didn't technically attend the school, thank you, because she didn't have money, thank you. But somebody thought she was very smart, and so they decided to tutor her because she you know, at that time, I mean, she was a single mother and jobs. I don't know the full story, but I know that she was taken, someone was taking care of her, you know. So.
As the American, as it was Emerson College. When I went, they had dropped the school laboratory. But still, here were two classes that I took. One was with Arthur Eads. I never forgot his name. And all he taught was the pronunciation of composers, foreign composers. I forget the rest of his name, you know, Shostakovich.
Mm-hmm. And taught you how to say the composer's name?
Yeah. That was the course. That was the course. All the composers.
Do you
names.
Feel like elocution and or you know, oratory skills should be taught in schools?
Elocution, no, not necessarily. I think there are many more important things. But
the ability to speak and to defend points, so on and so forth. I mean, we don't really
defend points is another isn't articulation.
Yeah. But I'm wondering if we have say extracurricular programs for those types of things. But I'm wondering. I was always wondering if that should be something that's more in line with the curriculum. Because
exactly is oratory? Like, I mean, I know, but
oratory. I am now orating.
So how to speak?
I was really having a conversation earlier, but now.
But you can people could have wonderful ideas, and they just might not have had the the people around them to teach them how to persuade people, with language.
That falls under oratory, is persuasion.
I'm throwing it under kind of a general. I'm generalizing it, but because we went to a school that was specializing in this, and I'm thinking about today, lots of people with lots of ideas, and there are certain people that are really good at saying things, and they have terrible ideas, but they're really good at saying them.
Things
through. And I always wonder if that's something that should be taught more, a newer form of it, I don't know, something I've thought
you
about.
You talked a moment ago about your grandparents.
Yeah.
And in the context, in your context, I would be like your grandparents. So I'm trying to figure, what is the difference between our ages? You are?
I'm 30 years old.
You're 30 years old. It's very, very easy. I'm 65 years older.
Is that all?
I am twice as old as you plus.
Well, then you've got a lot to teach.
Yeah. You know something? I think of it the other way, too.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I guess.
And you've been through a shitload at your age. You were married for a couple of years?
Yeah, I'm separated right now. And
and you separated and announced your gaydom.
Yeah, and I was manic when I did that, and I realized that I was bisexual. The media,
bisexual and bipolar.
Being manic and having access to the media is a dangerous combination. But at the end of the day, I was happy that I did that and talked about it. Actually, here. I did it. Yeah, I talked with Brady Stanellis, who's someone I know pretty well. I've always just used my platform to kind of help myself, kind of. Manage the narrative in my own head, of what's going on. But to be honest, I can't even really remember that podcast. I can't remember a lot of the stuff that happened over the past few years.
The podcast you did here.
Yeah, well, mania kind of obliterates your memory.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a
thing. But you understand Paul. I don't know if you know his background. I'm sitting here with a little paragraph in front of me, so I know the background. So he... Well, I'll read to you what it says here. Married in 2013 to a lady until he came out as a gay in 2015. Michael was open with her about his bisexuality.
Yes.
And are you a bit bipolar also?
I'm unfortunately very bipolar. Bipolar 1, rapid cycling with psychotic features.
So why'd you take on so much? You didn't need that.
Oh, I just was like, give me the whole load. When I was born, I was like, I'd like everything, please. That neurological disorder sounds great, and it's fun. It certainly feels like it can be sometimes.
There are degrees of bipolar?
The DSM has a spectrum from 1 to 2 to cyclothemic, like, which is bipolar light in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's just varying degrees of it, but I went, you know, very quickly up in terms of a diagnosis, and it's been, you know, since I started feeling it when I was 16, and I had my first full-on manic episode and suicide attempt when I was 18.
So manic doesn't necessarily mean, I always think manic means, I don't know why I think this, because I'm uneducated, which is, it's great that you're talking about this. I always think manic means a manic upswing. I think positive, not that you would commit suicide. Not positive, that is a positive experience, but that you get ideas and they might be a little out there. But can you explain that?
Yeah. Mania is, people like to think like, oh, if I could just bottle up mania and take that, that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
You know? There is a window between when what they call euthymic, when you're all right. I mean, I'm pretty much, without my meds, I'm somewhere, you know, on either down or up, usually on the upside now.
Yeah.
My brain has changed since I was in my early 20s. But mania is really very misunderstood and romanticized a bit, you know, understandably, because it's hard to talk about. There is a window of time where you are lucid and you're thinking really fast and clearly, or at least you think so for a while, and you're very productive. You don't need a lot of sleep. You don't need to eat. You don't. You're really extremely charismatic beyond belief. You can find anything and anyone interesting. Absolutely anything. And the productivity is like addictive. And so that's why a lot of people who are hypomanic won't take their meds or you know talk to a doctor, because they think, well, I'm doing so well right now. Why would I want to stop this?
Yeah.
But think of it this way. It's kind of like bipolar 1, which is what the classic bipolar disorder, manic depression, as we understand it, is like a feedback loop that goes either positive or negative, as in too much or too little. So it either goes to the point where if it's going and you're there in that window that I was just describing, it's going to go way much further, and it's going to get to a point where it's just chaos, and you're to the point of hallucinations, complete incoherence, pressured speech, like no one can understand what I'm saying. Like when I was working on stuff, people would have to record me, and even then, there'd be 50-minute to an hour-long conversations where no one could even get a word in edgewise. But I was just coming up with all these ideas and everything, and you're fun to be around sometimes, like, you know, until you're extremely irritable. And if someone gets in your way and you need to do something, it's the end of that relationship. Most of the problems in my life have come from manic episodes, nearly almost every problem. And also, then again, so have a lot of really great, you know, things I've worked on. You know,
that's what I was going to ask, how it affects the creativity.
There's a big thing right now where people are trying to figure out how to make people kind of manic instead of give them amphetamines, you know, that get them to a point where their brains are more active, but it's not like speed.
Through meds?
Like modafinil, Nuvigil, these drugs that they give, like, you know, jet pilots and stuff. It's weird stuff.
But as opposed to Adderall.
To jet pilots?
Yeah, to stay up and stuff. Wakefulness drugs, things like that.
As opposed to Adderall.
Yeah, guys who are flying 100 people are getting meds?
I mean, I don't think commercial flights. You know, they test everything on the military. So, but I'm just saying that, like, the idea is to get it there, to that place. And there's really no way to get it there without it cycling out of control. And no matter what, it always cycles out of control. And then here's the other thing. When the suicides tend to happen, this attempts, and the successful, we use the word successful, which is the creepiest thing to me, But it's true. Successful suicide attempts end up occurring during the fall from a manic episode back into a normal state or a depressive episode. So back into that window, or so that's what we call the mixed states.
Right.
And I suffer in my 20s a lot from the mixed states, and a lot of my work was about that. It's not confusing enough to be in your 20s, like a hormonal nightmare,
yeah.
Going through all these things and then putting your wife through it and your friends and family. It's very, very difficult, and you have to just – it teaches you a lot of gratitude is one way, one word, but empathy and complete understanding and just
– And then with all of that, did you need bisexuality also? What did you need?
It turns out,
what did you need with that?
I was like, make it harder. But when I was a kid, actually, I've never told this story. But when I was a kid, I had a boyfriend and a girlfriend, and I just thought. And where I lived in New Jersey, I grew up in New Jersey. I was born in New Brunswick, New Jersey. I lived there till I was about 12, and I had this girlfriend and boyfriend. I thought love was like that. It could be normal, fluidity was. In my head, normal. And then I moved to Buffalo, and I just got bullied, and I also suffered from several molestations as a child, too, in particular, that just made me so afraid of approaching or even talking about anything other than heterosexuality. I was just trying to fit in. I was just trying to make everything work, and then I kind of used music as a way to kind of get out of that, by the way. Because then girls and the guys that were making fun of me, like, they had to shut up because all the girls liked me. And I was like, yeah. You know? Always use art as a way to shield yourself. But
always use art as a way to shield yourself?
In a way. Then after a while, then it exposes you. But, you know, or people.
I like both those words in that context.
You know what I mean? I'm always like, if I'm shielding myself with it, I'm still writing myself through it anyway. You know? All I needed to do was actually deal with my trauma, was that I've always been bisexual and I've always had those urges, but I didn't know that I was suffering from PTSD. And that exacerbates the bipolar. So, you know, I don't like to think that, like, my bipolar disorder did anything for me. There's a creative edge. It's been proven, whatever. But I think, you know, we can argue just as many people, like 70 or 80% of people with the disorder are on the ADA. So it's not really that, maybe. That could be talking more about privilege or something else. But at the end of the day, I made all that stuff despite these issues. And I wrote about them. I didn't know what else to write about. I mean, to be frankly, I'm a little tired of writing about them. I mean, that's why I'm starting to write different types of
narratives. When you say write about them, are you talking about music?
Yeah, music. I'm very blunt and frank and in all my interviews. I've always been that way. I'm almost positive at this point now that I'm the first person to write a record in 2012 about a full manic episode, front to back, from the trigger to the suicide attempt.
Really?
Called Gossamer.
Called
Gossamer.
Gossamer.
Yeah, and no one understood it really at the time.
I remember how did it go?
It went really well. I had my first.
Can you repeat some of it?
Oh, the album.
The one of the songs.
Oh well.
The song that best illustrates the album.
There's a song called Where We Belong, which is the last song on the record, which is when I was descending from a manic episode, where I was drinking about a liter of gin a day for 2 months, and I'd run away. My wife tracked me down, brought me back, all this stuff. And I remember it was me recalling the first suicide attempt when I was just about to turn 19. And my bath, and it went through the entire process. I mean, just visually through it. I remember I was hallucinating because I was having a psychotic episode, and I thought like the Archangel Gabriel was coming and swooping me up, and so that's what led me to walk until around the apartment until my roommate came over and was like, what's going on? And I was bleeding through my coat, and I went to the hospital and the whole thing. And that's, it was...
You were bleeding from your coat?
Yeah, I was. And actually, I sat in triage for like 3 hours because I didn't want to tell anyone what had happened. I was passing out on the floor. It was so, because at that time, it's really embarrassing to talk about. This was 2007, six. So I just didn't, no one seemed very nice, and I was, and I also was really sick. I had taken a bunch of medicine, so. So, but it talks about all of that stuff in the lyrics. It's actually was very difficult to sing live, but most of the songs, you know, you get to a place where I guess it's kind of like, you know, the trauma therapy, EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprocessing, where they, you know, it's like my music has functioned that way for me as a way to kind of deal with the trauma. It's which a lot of people with bipolar have to deal with when they go through episodes. They have to like kind of go through trauma therapy because the episodes themselves are so traumatic. So, and I had no idea. So a lot of my the stuff, all this media stuff, was a lot of just not knowing what the heck was going on.
I was married for 30 years to a woman who was extremely bipolar, who didn't know she was bipolar. Nobody had informed her. She hadn't been, you know, until I was in therapy. We were both about 50, about the same age. And he told her, "You're bipolar. You've been bipolar."
It's the eyes. He can I mean, yeah.
And then came, what the hell's the drug?
Lithium.
Lithium.
Yeah, lithium. Yeah. If I don't take my lithium, this conversation would be, well, I'd be talking at you, not with you. Basically. You know, but
yeah. I thought you'd been doing that all along.
Oh, well, you know, there was a certain point where
I'm
I was like,
fed up with it.
you know, it's a drug that it's been out since 1972. It's one of the longest.
Yes, you know. The guy who brought lithium, I can't remember his name. He was a doctor in New York. I brought him out here as soon as I found out, and we found out that she was bipolar and so forth, diagnosed by a guy I was seeing. I did two episodes with Maud, and she was bipolar, and we used. He came out to consult with us, this doctor who had brought lithium to the country. I wish I could remember his name.
So the character Maud was,
B. Arthur, not the woman, the character.
The character was bipolar.
Yeah, we dealt with that.
Mom.
Yeah,
I know you did. Yeah.
Did you tour Gossamer?
I mean, thank you, because that was it was well done. It was hard to do.
It was very hard to do.
That's great.
You're hard to do. My God, you have not had an easy time of it.
Well, you know, I didn't make it easy for anyone else either. You know, I just that's what bipolar people do. We just bring everyone around, and everyone's like, "What's going on?" And then you know, it's just I thought this was a party. No, it's a haunted house. It's crazy. until you turn the lights back on, everyone's like, "It's a party again." Oh my God, I can't stand it. It's got to be one thing or the other, and you're like, "I like it both ways."
That's the best line I've ever heard.
Speaking of liking it both ways, you are bisexual.
Yes.
So, Tom Cruise is married to Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
When they were married, they bumped into Michael. A little bit of preference in one direction or the other?
You know,
asking this in the most naive, stupid, friggin' way.
Actually, these are kind of the best questions I've been asked. I've been wanting to talk about this for a while, and I wanted to talk about it with you, Norman.
Yes.
what's so interesting is that, like, I was talking to my therapist about this, and I think, because of my childhood issues and what happened to me, and also just because I forced myself to and had really good relationships with women, I tend to actually I prefer women in terms of partners. So that's what I didn't understand. I thought like I'm this. I gotta get out of here. And my wife was like, "What?" And then, you know, it was as confusing as it probably sounds like it would be, more so, and humiliating and weird, and I had no idea, no concept of it, I just thought like all this pain has to be that, and it was a slew of other things in terms of my preferences. Like I don't really I know that like I've had the best partner in a woman, you know, so far in my life. That, you know, my wife has just recently saved my life. I was hospitalized about 2 months ago, right before the tour that we just did, which almost didn't happen because I had been manic for 2 years and she wasn't around, or no one was really there to kind of help. And she just barged in. She's like, "All right, we're going to the hospital." And she just knows me. She can read me like a book, you know. Other people kind of can, or I'm really good at getting around it, or something, you know.
You're doing a great job today.
Well, yeah, it's because of her that I am doing any job today. Really, I was hospitalized. I did electroconvulsive therapy.
Yeah.
Which I did 4 of, and then I was like, I remember
what kind of therapy? Convulsive?
ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, shock therapy. Which, you know, after a while, whatever gets you there, and it's not like I'm, you know, dumber or weirder or anything. I feel like myself again, and I just played 20 plus shows. Almost all of them were sold out. With 9 days off, you know, I can't believe I did it, but I almost want to be like, you know, enough. I don't want to keep like, you know, jumping out of the hospital and going on tour. But if I have a job and I'm supposed to do something, I try to fulfill all my obligations. That's the thing. People with bipolar, they lose that social credit. You know, you have to build that social credit back up, and you do anything possible. And like one of those things is just like I wish I could wear a sign around my neck just saying, I'm on lithium. You know, just so people like trust what I'm saying. You know, because I say a lot of things, but then when I'm on lithium, like people kind of know, okay, he's all right. And that's okay, you know, like because I'm lucky to be alive. Like I don't care really that much.
We're all lucky to be alive. Yeah. You know, Paul has heard me say this 100 times. It is hard to be a human being.
It's
for every human being. I don't care how unlucky or how lucky in conventional sense, it's just hard to be a human being.
I agree, and I also think that when I talk about bipolar disorder, it's like I have it harder than other people. It's like I just have it harder in a different way. I know other people without diagnoses that go through, in fact, in many ways, I'd have to say harder, really abstract things that are this is a neurological disorder. Like there may not be biomarkers and so on and so forth. There may be a lot of issues with it right now, but at the end of the day, I know just as many people that don't have the diagnosis or whatever that go through and have been through way harder things, in my opinion. And so I always get uncomfortable when I talk about my problems in that respect, because I don't want to feel like, well, listen to my pain and everything. I try to, it's a way of me saying like we have something in common, you know. It might not be the same type of pain, but pain is something we can talk about when we're feeling better, you know, like when we're on the way to the other side. And the last record I put out, actually all the proceeds go to the Broad Institute for genetic research.
For maniacs.
For
crazy people.
Yeah. God bless us all. For the three of us in this room.
Exactly.
Somebody once said, and I've always thought it was one of the wisest things I've ever had. I've never been able to trace the line. Each man is my superior in that I may learn from him. And I've never heard anything I thought was, and there are lots of things I believe are true, but nothing truer than that. Each man is my superior.
I agree.
And I may learn from him. And you are an education. I mean, what you've been through at 30 years, only 30 years, is just phenomenal.
And expressing it through art, which is, aren't we lucky to have you?
Thank you.
I
appreciate that. But, you know, I got it's the audacity. It's the, like, it's the ability to do that crazy thing that everyone's like, you don't do that. Don't talk about that. Which, when I mean, I was just watching your documentary about a couple months ago. And when they were telling you, like, with All in the Family, like, it was that you were gonna, they were gonna, it was gonna blow the roof off, and mm-hmm. you're gonna get tons of calls, but you knew that you couldn't keep going the way you were going with network television the way it was if you didn't do something like that. And I had to release a record about this type of thing. Whether or not it was going to make a difference or not, I didn't know. But I just knew in my gut that it was the right thing to do.
How is the record doing?
I think it's about to go gold. I know we had a – I know Take a Walk, one of the singles, is
– great song.
Thanks.
Have we mentioned the name of the album on this podcast yet?
Gossamer. And then Tremendous Sea of Love I just released for free, all this, if you stream it, money goes to Harvard and MIT for research. But everything I do now is basically for just to raise awareness for that stuff. So
should it make a lot of money? It's going to go to research.
I mean, I hope it does. But right. I mean, it says. I mean,
that's the way it's set up.
If people let's stream it enough, you're a philanthropist if you stream it. Congratulations.
If you stream it on Spotify?
Spotify, Apple.
All right, I helped. Yeah. I did something.
Yeah, you gave money.
Yeah.
There you go. Just by putting yourself through that.
No, it's great. I enjoyed it.
Thanks.
I wanted to ask you if you toured Gossamer.
We toured Gossamer, and then we did that. That was in 2012, and then I released a record called Kindred, and then I released a record. Yeah, then I released Tremendous Sea of Love.
But the reason I asked about Gossamer is because that's the one that you wrote about,
right?
Yeah, from start to the suicide attempt.
Yep.
Would you do that? The shows? Would you do that in order? Was it was that a journey? What was that like every night for you singing those songs?
Just our last show was just a few nights ago, actually, here in LA, and we played about 6-7 songs off the record. And it's, the older I get, the more I listen to the lyrics.
And is it cathartic? Is it
get better with age or something? it is actually. Performing is kind of this weird meditative state where you don't really remember the show. You kind of just are in the. I don't think about the lyrics. It's all muscle memory, and I act out these parts, but some once in a while I'll catch a couple lyrics, and they're pretty tough.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I always, I'm a fan of, like, I just have always been a fan of making things as pretty as possible. Like, my head has always been a nightmare, so I don't understand why I would do anything other than, like, make something more beautiful or prettier. And I also found it was a lot easier to sing, ironic, but easier to sing about these things when it was pretty, because that seemed to both speak to the dichotomy within my head and also just the nature of the illness. And then also it's crazy to see people jumping up and down singing along to these really depressing lyrics to a really fun song. And it's like, well, that's basically what it's like. Kind of letting everyone live through it a little bit.
There's a good tradition of that. And for instance, Bruce Springsteen talks about it. It's called a Dance on Your Problems. If you think of his biggest hit, which was Hungry Heart, the opening lines are, got a wife and kids in Baltimore, Jack. I went out for a ride and I never went back. Yeah. And everybody's singing along and stuff. You've taken it to another level.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Yeah. I actually, Bruce Springsteen once watched our show, and he called me the Digital Beach Boys, and I just went backstage and cried.
Ah, that's fantastic.
Have you seen him on Broadway?
No, I want to see that.
Oh, my God. I want you to see that.
Is it good?
He's
a great guy. I'm on his label. I'm on Columbia.
He's fabulous. I mean, I think he's the best preacher, philosopher, poet, musician. He's all those things wrapped
He's
in
super
one.
Smart. Yeah.
He's just great. Patriot.
Yeah. Yeah. Unbelievable.
He is.
He's been doing it.
I was knocked out. Just knocked out.
He came to LA or was
no,
it?
No, no, no.
It was in New York.
On Broadway.
It was in
New York.
That's right. Those tickets are crazy, right?
He's extended it for a long time.
Yeah. I think, the older I get, the more I realize, I wish I'd seen Leonard Cohen, and he's someone who talked about, like, a lot of, like, struggles, like, mm-hmm. specifically depression and living through it. And I feel like there was a way of doing it that was still very shrouded, and I was I suppose I have a product of my age where I was like, I'm going to just talk about it as bluntly as possible and see what people think. And it's like, it was the most terrifying. And you must have been terrified when you tried something, when you were trying, I mean, with all the family or like, I mean, you're breaking something. You're breaking a norm.
But, you know, I didn't feel I was. What I was dealing with, what we're talking about now, just isn't talked about enough. But it's the stuff of life. I recognize how difficult everything you've been through is. And don't realize it enough, because I haven't been through it. But I can appreciate it. But it's nothing I didn't know about far less before I met you, but knew about. I live, as I said, with a woman who was manic depressive. We were dealing with everyday problems that families dealt with. It just wasn't, they didn't talk about it. Like, we're not talking about the president we have right now. Really, there is no real conversation about the depths of his sickness or whatever word you want to use to describe what our current president is.
Yeah.
There is no national conversation about any of the things that really are the stuff of life.
Why do you think that is?
Why do I think that is? It won't sell. We do.
It won't sell because I think, you know, so say like someone on the floor of Congress or something is trying to push something through. When they're trying to push something through in this vein, it almost says something about them, like they have a problem. There's a self-stigma, because this is all stigma. The stigma around, I mean, this is the last human rights issue I think we have worldwide. It affects every single culture. It's a worldwide epidemic, global epidemic on a scale that is so unprecedented. It's the camps in Lesbos, the Syrian refugee camps, and the rate of PTSD in the children that are there. I mean, it is unbelievable what data we have to show proof of it, like that. What's happening at schools. I mean, we're talking about it in ways, we're talking about what it's about. Yeah, so we're getting closer, but it comes down to trauma. It comes down to, I mean, it is so universal that it's going to take probably another 20 years for there to be some serious action. I've been advocating for 6 years now, and I have found that advocating has actually made my life harder. I've actually found that it made my life harder.
And you are advocating for what specifically?
I've done many PSAs for mental health. I've done many PSAs for, I've done a lot of interviews about it. I started a nonprofit. We've been working towards like advocacy, you know, protection, you know, and incentivizing getting, you know, because there is absolutely no net, you know, for people, kids who go online and social media platforms and talk about stuff, hashtag mental health awareness week, whatever. They're just generating intellectual property for these giant, you know, social media platforms, so on and so forth, and that they go back to school, and the systems aren't better. And, you know, the kids aren't less judgmental, and it's so the conversation is not being had because it makes, if anyone's having the conversation, they're afraid that it makes them look like they have a problem, even if they're just trying to have a conversation. Usually people who talk about it have the problem, And there's got to be, we have to develop a vernacular and a way of talking about it that somehow makes it easier for people who don't have the problem to talk about it and to help and to participate. Because many people don't have the problem and help. That's just, they're not talking about it. And I think talking about it also isn't enough until we kind of can't talk about it almost. We have to just have action and actually have services and better, you know, utilities. Services, things that can help get people help faster, quicker, and with, you know, more, you know, privacy, until we're at a place where the conversation is effective. Mm-hmm. I think it's terrifying for people. I mean, to me, it's in many ways. They told me it was going to be career suicide. The label told me that, and maybe they
who told you that?
People at the label in 2012. They're like, don't talk about it. And I broke the rules and I talked about it anyway. I did a whole thing about it Because I was like, how am I going to, this is my life. And what, we're going to live in a world that's never going to, like, be safer for me? Like, I have a neurological disorder. This is a problem. Like mm-hmm. this is what I write about, and you know, here I am. But they didn't believe it would help anything or anything, so.
Are you finding, now that you're understanding a good deal more than you did 5 years ago, 10 years ago, finding true joy from time to time, where you can almost forget all the rest of it?
Age is pretty cool. I like getting older. Mm-hmm. I think my former wife told me, she's like, you get better with age, and like I finally just started kind of agreeing with her. I was like, I appreciate myself and I appreciate the crazy parts about me, but like I know how to kind of work with it, and I do find myself starting to be able to answer, you know, like, what do you like to do? And what are your hobbies? And almost getting to a point where I have answers for those things, mm-hmm. where I'm starting to take care of myself. So, yeah, I think that I'm getting to a place
where... How about you, Paul? You just had a birthday recently.
Yeah. Well, not that recently, but I do have one coming up.
When is it?
July. Near you. I'm near you.
You're right. Yeah. You're just a few days
older.
You're
cancer? Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, you're cancer?
Okay. I love getting older. I all the stuff that I know now... that I didn't know then. This year I will be 27 years without drugs and alcohol, and I got clean when I was 27. And a lot of the things that you're describing remind me.
Because he's not going to say it, but before, when he started to get into big trouble with all of this drugs and stuff, he was celebrated on Broadway. He was the star of a major hit. Tell him about it.
Well, yeah, it was a show called Buddy about Buddy Holly. I played Buddy Holly in it, you know, did the music.
Yeah,
and
what?
This.
Oh.
Yeah. And,
The Buddy Holly story. He did it in England first. And then
on Broadway. Yeah. And so, anyway, the lesson is don't get clean and sober, because I was a big success when I was a drunk, and now it's all falling apart. Now I'm a co-host on a podcast.
You know what's crazy is that I've struggled with drugs and alcohol as well.
I know when you said about a bottle of gin a day, I kind of perked up because I went, got that.
Yeah.
But
I can't do any of that stuff.
It was really interesting to hear you, because mine was sort of self-induced. It's nothing like, you know, what you have, but cocaine and alcohol and the behaviors and the lows and the highs, you know. And one of the first things somebody said to me that really got my, well, one of the first, there were many. You get sober, you get clean, and then all of a sudden life is, I mean, for me, a day used to be, you wake up and it's dark, and then it gets light, and then it gets dark, and then it gets light, and then it gets dark, and then it gets light, and then eventually you fall asleep.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get sober, and it's like, you wake up and it's light, and it gets dark, and you go to bed. It's like, what? Where's the excitement? Do you know what I mean? So my big trouble was happiness. I couldn't deal with if I got a glimpse of it, because I didn't know it. My constant companion was just full on mayhem. You know what I'm saying? So somebody said about, you know, the peaks being chopped off and the valleys being filled in and life being somewhere in this area.
Yeah.
Do you know? But anyway.
Exactly. And by the way, when I was saying, like, and he's on the theme now, it's like, it's the stigma that I deal with in the same percentile are former drug users, alcoholics.
There's a lot of that in.
The stigma has actually gone up for us.
The stigma's gone up for
people with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, former alcoholics, drug addiction issues. People don't, you know, I think it's about it's over 65%. Someone would correct me and say 68 or something, but went up about 20% since 2006 to 2016.
No kidding.
Yeah.
And what do we suppose the reason for that would be?
Fear.
Fear.
General fear.
So fear is on the rise.
When terror is a part of our national life, we present like, if I don't take my lithium, if you relapse, if I relapse,
terror and the absence of leadership.
Yeah, it permeates all aspects of life. In my opinion, this is the sociological take on it. But I mean, and truth be told, like, we have a lot in common.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a really the trust and rebuilding that stuff and everything. It's like it's, and by the way, the art and relating the art and the success with it is really, really hard.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's something interesting about the modern world too, about like where alcoholism and drug addiction is concerned. You know, that drunks used to be, first of all, they used to be institutionalized and just locked up, you know, and then 1935, Bill and Bob come along, they start this Alcoholics Anonymous. And then things start to get better. But drunks were the guys, like, they would go in the church basement. Like, it was still, mm-hmm. It was a shameful thing. Nobody talked about it and you couldn't mention it and everything. And then it sort of started to come into the mainstream. But then what happens now with a lot of things, and I'd be interested to know how this – if this happens with mental illness, it's an odd thing. These shows like Intervention and all these things, there is a glee about this. There is a sort of a Romanesque kind of watching people suffer in these shows. I think so that it has an opposite effect. Instead of educating and make people understand, it makes them – first of all, they like to watch the people being thrown to the lions.
It's like the ICE coming in.
But also they think they know it. And there's a pop culture version that is, we all know what sobriety is, and we all know about, you know, AA. And it's a very personal thing. And so I wonder if it keeps people either out of it, more people than it would bring into it or educate. Like, who's going to watch that and go, that's what I need?
It 100% takes them out of it.
Takes them out of it. I agree with you. And all the doctor this and the Dr. Oz, the doctor shows, you know, that guy, Dr. Drew.
When you begin to, I mean, I take a bit of an Orson Welles approach to television now, more of a educational platform. And you go, because we have television now is a lot different. You know, the dramas are on these paid networks and everything. It's changed. And it's such a wasted opportunity.
Yeah, agreed.
But it doesn't sell.
It doesn't sell. It will not sell if they do it purely.
But if you know what? What I'm looking for the genius who can sell it.
Right. Yeah. you may
be that genius.
I don't know. I mean, I think it would take a very convincing producer and production team. But there is absolutely.
But could you live with that?
What?
Being that genius? Could you allow yourself that?
To be a person that leads the mental health?
Whatever it is you know, the sea change you wish to see, if it turns out that you...
You know what, Norman? I'm disappointed that I feel like I might be one of the better people to lead it right now.
You're disappointed. You are.
That I haven't. No, but I just wish that I know that there are lots of people that want to try. They just, I don't know what it is. Well, I do know, and it's fear. But I guess I've dedicated just enough of my life to it, and I've gotten this far. You know, you just get far enough where you're like, oh, I'm just going to keep making stuff that's going to, you know, ruffle feathers. And if you believe in it enough, and because you know it and you understand, because bipolar people, I feel like, have a lot in common with we're the cocktail. You know, I understand autism. I understand schizophrenia. I understand depression. I understand anxiety. I understand. I know about all of these. I'm very well informed by neuroscientists who work with me and everything. And I try to understand as much as I can. But at the end of the day, I understand media, and I really believe that it just has to be done right. It has to be done sensitively, and you've got to be audacious, and you've got to be willing to break things. And I am so happy you brought that up about the shows, the intervention shows. They scare me.
Yeah.
They scare me.
I'm not a fan.
Not that anyone's had to necessarily do it that with me or anything, but they actually scare. They make it. It's not the way it looks.
Mm-mm.
At all. And there are people. There are just so many ways of dealing with these issues, and so many interesting, really cool, interactive ways. And there's many different platforms we can be exploring to try to, you know, it might not be television. I don't think it is television necessarily, but a lot of the people watch television. So I think that in terms of leading the conversation and or developing ways of portraying mental illness, I mean, I can tell you right now that I watched something and I'm like, there is obviously a better way to do this. And
have you seen the show I'm involved with right now, One Day at a Time? The new One Day at a Time?
No, I haven't seen it.
Well, the new One Day at a Time, have you seen enough of it to see what we're doing with
I'm binging season two. I'm in currently.
I can't, you know, my whole family.
Wait, I didn't know you were doing this show. I've been. Yeah,
second season, Netflix.
Oh.
And it's she is a, and she got two children and a grand, and a mother, Rita Moreno, who's living with her. And she served in Afghanistan, and her husband is still in Afghanistan. They're separated, but he's still there. And he's back for his daughter's quinceanera. It's a Latin rendition. They're from Cuba. And it's terrific. It's doing very well.
Oh, okay.
But I'm trying to remember why the hell what made me think of it. Oh, because she has PTSD.
I was just about to say,
And so does her husband.
That's in the world over, that's going to level the playing field, in my opinion, the dealing of trauma.
Well,
now I know what I'm watching next.
It's there on Netflix.
I just finished Homeland.
I can't express how happy it makes me that my three grown daughters, I have daughters, young daughters and older daughters, the three grown daughters who have children of their own and so forth, have all binge-watched this season. And it's a fucking thrill.
That's awesome. Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question how to handle this stuff in the media to make it attractive that people, but maybe it's not meant to be attractive. Shows, they show someone falling apart and it just, there's too much glee. And then there's an intervention, the either accidental effect of this or the intended effect, I don't know, but is now everybody thinks they know how to do an intervention or, the intervention's like dealing with mental illness, I would
intervention,
imagine. It's like brain surgery. It's a very delicate thing.
The word itself is scary.
Without expert guidance.
Yeah.
Without really thought out.
I just think that if it's going to be entertainment, it shouldn't be reality like that.
Right.
Because it's not reality. We all know that the reality television is not really reality. And if it's dealt with in drama, and there are ways to do that. That's actually probably if it's done carefully and it comes from a real place. I usually, even if it's dramatized a bit, like in Homeland, for instance, the way she gets ECT is not totally accurate or whatever. But you see someone get ECT.
Yeah.
And you see that person be brilliant and work really hard and have a life and try to work and look at that. They're on season 6 or 7, right? So not everything's perfect, but like, my God, she's probably done a lot for people with bipolar disorder in a way.
Scripted work.
Yeah, and I think in drama and shows and even comedies, like there are ways to deal with it correctly, and there's just a sense, it's got to come from a real place.
Mm-hmm.
That's it, and that's the rule. But then
you got to promise me you'll be in touch after you see a few episodes of One Day at a Time.
I mean, if you don't mind me telling you exactly, I'm so excited. I actually just finished a show, so I was just asking my friend what I was going to watch.
Oh, perfect. You smoke cigars by any chance?
I actually, I'm doing this on a podcast, my brother-in-law has cigars, and he, I always go over and have a cigar with him,
Well, maybe we could all have a cigar and discuss it.
What do you think of somebody who believes that if there was no other reason to believe in God, it would be Havana Leaf?
What do I think of that person? I'd want to hang out with them.
Yeah, there you go.
So here's what
we're on for a smoke.
Here's what we were both came across at the same moment. We are two of about 11 when we, guys, 11, 12 guys, it varies depending on who's in town, who feel that way about Havana Leaf and who are into music.
Yeah.
I'm the only one who came into music as an executive, don't play an instrument.
But he sings his ass
off. I hear you sing.
But sing my ass off.
Yeah.
And
by the way, you have excellent taste.
But you're about to get the golden ticket here.
In you know, every three, we try to do it as often as we can. Glenn Barrows, who runs Concord Records, happens to be a wine aficionado like none I have ever known. And he'll talk to my cook, whoever's cooking that night, for 2 days before he actually cooks. And we come together and we have a meal with wines that...
For each course.
For each course and conversation about the wines and the food, and the chef talks about the food. It's a fucking love affair.
It is the best. It's
unbelievable. And then we'll go out on the terrace and we'll all light up. And everybody has already put their instruments out there.
We play guitars and we've got a keyboard player. And we just sit out and howl at the moon until 1 a.m.
Oh, my God.
And play music.
It's fabulous.
Be great if you.
So you're going to hear about it the next time.
It is beyond an honor.
You're going to love it. It's great.
Amazing.
He would be the youngest by 20 years or so.
I've been on boards where I'm the youngest by 30. Yeah, I like that.
How can I be?
I'm an older soul, frankly.
You are an old soul. This is very true.
But I also, I maintain the youth to your brain. I'm like, I'm kind of over it now. Turning 30, I was like, thank God, I'm almost there.
It's just a number until I hear 30 and I go, let's see, I'm 24 years older than a 30-year-old. And then I look at Norman, who's 65 years older than a 30-year-old.
Yeah, but you look young.
Holy and going shit. Strong. News, and with a new wait. Show on another pilot he's about to shoot. So,
King.
Yeah.
King. The king. The king. All hail the king.
The show is called Guess Who Died.
Have you dealt with alcoholism on your shows? I'm sure you have.
Oh,
but
sure. Oh, sure.
That's tough,
did,
too.
Did that on Maud. I did that on several shows.
Yeah.
Even though, didn't you do it on an episode with All in the Family?
We did.
Yeah. And the rape scene, too. I mean, I wrote a paper on that.
That was two episodes.
And the birth in the
elevator.
In the elevator.
My God, the memories.
Yeah.
But we're going to be wrapping it up now because it's become that time. We're not going to. We didn't have before this, and we're not going to have a better half hour, an hour, about an hour.
Which is great.
Talking to anybody than this conversation with Michael,
and listen to Passion
and Tillichos.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Isn't that a great name?
Angelicos? Yeah, really great.
It means of the angels in Greek.
It's Greek.
Yeah, very.
That too. I'm ending this episode on an island.
And everybody listen to Passion Pit because the music is great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Norman Lear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Ipp.
And life is good, and space and time. Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine.
Hey humans, David Smalley here from the Dogma Debate Podcast, right here on Podcast One, where we talk about all the things you're not supposed to discuss at work: religion, politics, abortion, racism, slavery.
And that's only when we open the Bible.
We discuss Islam, Islamophobia.
What does that even mean?
We chat with vegans, animal rights activists, and even visit factory farms to see it for ourselves. I invite people from multiple backgrounds to convert me into their worldview. But as long as they're okay with being respectfully challenged,
you better bring your evidence.
And I never lose sight of how both the left and the right are seeming to lose their minds. So basically, we're solving all the world's problems right here on Dogma Debate.
And you've been missing it.
Download Dogma Debate on iTunes, Stitcher, or PodcastOne.com.